This is Sarwar Kashmiri, welcoming you to the third podcast in the Foreign Policy Association series of six conversations on the state of U.S.-China relations. This podcast with Ms. Bonnie Glazer and the following one with Professor Toshi Yoshihara deal with the military and national security aspects of the relationship. Ms. Glazer is the Senior Advisor for Asia and Director of the China Power Project at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She is also a non-resident fellow with the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. Ms. Glazer has written extensively on various aspects of Chinese foreign policy, including Sino-US relations, US-China military ties, China's relations with Japan and Korea, and Chinese perspectives on missile defense and multilateral security in Asia. Ms. Glazer joins me from her offices in Washington, D.C. Here's our conversation. So, Ms. Glazer, you were at the Shangri-La Dialogue, the annual meeting of senior policymakers in defense and national security that's held in Singapore. And what is your reflection on it? Do you think what you heard reflects the tensions that are echoed in headlines in newspapers? What's your takeaway?
Well, this is the eighth Shangri-La dialogue that I have attended, and I often find that the headlines, not surprisingly, focus on the tensions between the United States and China. And of course, that's particularly true in recent years with Chinese activity in the South China Sea. 2012, when China took over control of Scarborough Shoal, 2014, when it started the land reclamation, and this year as well, in advance of the tribunal ruling in the case that the Philippines brought against China. And I must admit that as a participant, I find the conversation is much richer. It is focused on non-traditional security issues, terrorism challenges that the region faces. There's lots of conversations among participants who are not only the defense ministers.
Right.
They, of course, are at the plenary sessions. We had a very good breakout session this year on the South China Sea. There was a good discussion on cybersecurity. So really, the Shangri-La dialogue, I think, is really successful in that it brings together people from inside government as well as experts from outside and tries to bring to the forefront what some of the problems are and then tries to, of course, talk about what some solutions might be, confidence-building measures, for example. So it really isn't quite like the tone that we see in the headlines of major newspapers.
And do you find the Chinese are equal participants? They're part of all the roundtables and discussions and so on, or do they stick kind of in the corner of the room and let the rest of you go ahead with it?
Chinese participation is only lacking at the highest level. They've only sent their defense minister once in 2007.
Uh-huh.
So the representative from China is lower level than all of the other countries generally that are participating. However, at the working level, and particularly in these breakout sessions, there's usually a Chinese on every single panel. They are very well prepared in the plenary sessions. They ask questions. They engage on the margins with people who are attending. The Chinese official delegation has a very large number of separate sessions with the Chinese official delegation.
Right.
Has a very large number of sessions with delegations from other countries. I believe it was over two dozen this year. So they really use that opportunity to engage with other countries on security issues. So I would say in virtually every way, the Chinese are really involved. They've stepped up except for the highest level representative. Maybe someday the Chinese will once again send their defense minister, but I think it's a challenge for them.
Now, you mentioned the Court of Arbitration ruling against China on the so-called nine-dash line, where the court said that they were rejecting China's claims. What impact do you think that has? Is it a big deal?
I think it is really quite significant. And of course, the Permanent Court of Arbitration did not dismiss China's sovereignty claims over land because it is not a power to do that, but ruled on a number of other issues where it does have jurisdiction. And the most important here is China's claim of historic right over waters that are not associated with land. And the ruling was very much in favor of the Philippines. And I don't think anybody expects that China's position will change overnight. China rejected the ruling 3 years ago when the Philippines first brought the case.
Right.
And of course, it rejected the decision when it was issued in July. But I think over time, we might see some change in China's behavior. And ultimately, that's what I think every country would like to see. Less harassment by Chinese ships of fishermen from other countries, for example. So China spent an enormous amount of resources and time and energy opposing this ruling, which I think reveals to the world that China cares very much about a tribunal under the Convention on the Law of the Sea giving an award that is against China. This is not something that China thinks is has marginal impact. This is about China's international reputation. China doesn't want to be seen as an outlaw, as a nation that is undermining the international system.
How does America not ratifying the treaty that Philippines brought the charges against, how does that look in the view of the world? I mean, are we saying, is the U.S. saying that we really don't care about this? And if so, then what's the big deal about the ruling? Would it help if the United States ratified?
I think that the United States position would be strengthened if it ratified the Law of the Sea Convention. But at the same time, the United States abides by all of the elements of UNCLOS as customary law.
I see.
There is no case in which the United States says we do not implement this aspect of UNCLOS because we are not a signatory to the treaty. There was one case which is really very well known years ago when the U.S. lost a case in the International Court of Justice against Nicaragua.
Right.
Unlike China, the United States did go to the court and argue that it did not have jurisdiction. The United States then lost and it withdrew and did not participate in the merits argument of the case. And subsequently, although the ruling was against the United States, the U.S. over time essentially came into compliance with that ruling. I think it was a mistake. It is always a mistake, I think, when a great power such as the United States does not abide by international law, because
right.
then we lose our moral authority.
Yes.
And other countries say, well, if the U.S. opposed this, so can we. And China has, in fact, done that. So, yes, it would help, but I don't think it would fundamentally change the situation since the United States already is in compliance with the treaty.
Well, let me switch to a couple of hard military-type issues. So the United States has obviously taken the position that it is a Pacific power. It has guaranteed freedom of navigation for all these years, and it will continue to do so. And a large part of its power projection is the enormously powerful nuclear attack carrier groups. Now, I understand from a number of reports that China over the last decade has developed missiles which make it very risky for American carrier groups to get within 800 miles of the Chinese shore. If that is the case, where does the power projection ability come from, and how is the U.S. going to maintain its position?
Well, it is certainly true that in recent years the Chinese have been working on developing a missile that is known as the Carrier Killer.
Yes.
The DF-21B.
Indeed.
And we have not seen this tested against a moving target at sea.
Uh-huh.
So nobody really knows how effective it is. At the same time, I'm fairly confident that the United States has worked hard to try and disrupt various points of the kill chain in China's capabilities. So its ability to target that carrier its ability to launch that missile and hone in on it. So I think I would not be so confident if I were China that I could take out that aircraft carrier. And then, of course, one also has to consider what would be the implications of attacking a carrier.
Exactly.
How would that escalate? How would the United States respond? So it is certainly the case that in 1996, when the United States, under then-President Clinton, dispatched two aircraft carriers to the area around Taiwan after China lobbed missiles at the island, that the United States could do that with impunity. It had very little concern, if any, that China would be able to target and actually attack an aircraft carrier. That is not true today. There is a risk, but I think that the United States has not put up the white flag and said we have lost ability to gain access in a crisis. It's a much more complex situation
sure.
than it was, but I think that the United States continues to operate on the assumption in its plans that it is going to be able to gain access in a crisis if one were to emerge in the seas around China's coast.
Do you think that the age of the aircraft carrier is passing and that the United States should rely much more on its submarine force?
I don't think that the age of carriers has disappeared, but it is certainly possible if we want to look out 20, 30 years from now that many countries will conclude that carriers are not worth the investment. The United States, of course, continues to have 11, and ironically, China is now investing substantially in them, having purchased its first one and now developing at least two indigenous carriers. So
right.
Here the irony may be that China is getting in on this game just when they may become less useful. But of course, in peacetime, they demonstrate a commitment that the United States has to the region. And so I think it is important that the United States maintains carriers in order to be able to reassure nations, and particularly our allies in the Asia Pacific, that we are present and that we are committed to the region. Clearly, if we give up that carrier capability and we rely on undersea capabilities, that reassurance challenge becomes more difficult.
And in closing, let me ask you, the Australian strategist, Professor Hugh White, has said that there are three options the U.S. faces in East Asia. One is to leave and grant primacy to China. The other is to say we are always going to be the primary power. And three, to find a way to share power with China. What do you think about those three options?
I think that Hugh White, mutual accommodation scenario is described in a way that U.S. and China sit down and basically divide up the ocean, or they decide today in advance what will be China's areas of operation that the United States perhaps will not enter into, and vice versa.
Right.
So I find that the mutual accommodation scenario that I would endorse is very different. It's one that happens over a very long period of time. And indeed, I would say that the U.S. and China are already engaged in this process, not so much militarily, but if we look at the overall relationship, there are ways in which the United States does accommodate to China's rise and, in fact, supports the emergence of Chinese power if it is used in a way that supports international norms and rules and addresses regional and global problems. But I don't think that we should be sitting down and negotiating that accommodation in advance. I think as issues arise, there will be ways that the U.S. and China learn to work together and avoid accidents. So I think that this is a process. I do not believe that war is between the U.S. and China is inevitable.
You've been listening to a conversation with Ms. Bonnie Glaser, recorded for the Foreign Policy Association's podcast series on U.S.-China relations. The music on all these podcasts was performed by the Norwich University Regimental Band. We invite you to tune in for the next conversation in the series. Until then, this is your host, Sarwar Kashmiri. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.